Hello and welcome to Building Our Future with me, Bert Broadhead, for episode 31. Today, we're exploring the concepts of community and social value within real estate. What does it mean? How can it be created? And does a truly virtuous circle exist where developers and communities can benefit hand in hand? To answer that question, I'm lucky enough to be joined by someone who's been putting the theory into practice across the globe within the educational sector. My guest today is Andrea Pizzicone, a singer, songwriter, and social entrepreneur. She is the founder of Africa Integras, a developer and financier of education infrastructure in Africa, as well as the co-founder of Compositions for a Cause, which creates cause-related music to inspire activism for social justice. I think you're also founder of a Christie company,
which is
linked to Africa Integras.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit about the work you're doing in the real estate sphere?
Well, I've been doing community development of different kinds for quite some time now, since I was a pipsqueak. I started in New Haven, working with Yale University. They were looking for an innocent lamb kind of presence. I had this idea for an Italian restaurant that I wanted to see on campus that I had found in New York during an internship while I was in college.
What were you studying?
I was studying music.
Right. Okay.
And history. Yeah. And then I came over here for graduate school and I studied land economy.
Right.
But at the time, plan was go into music, but I'm classically trained. So there's a lead time. You know, your voice isn't really ready into your 30s. So what was I going to do in between? My mom was an urban educator, and I always had a passion for community development, income inequality, social justice, and human rights. And so wanted to do something in that sphere. Was interning with the mayor of New York at the time. And it was a very exciting time because...
Who was mayor about?
Giuliani.
That was Giuliani.
And it was a different time for him. They were really pushing the envelope in a lot of different ways. His mindset and his attitude changed over the years. Back then, it was very fresh and it was relevant. He didn't get everything right. And I think they've had time to reflect, and some on his team have reflected differently than others about what he did with racial justice and the police. And I think his philosophy on that, not to digress, but I think it's important when I talk about I worked with Giuliani, what does that mean? Because I was very involved with, his chief counsel was my mentor and one of my first investors for Africa Integras and Christie Company. And I wrote city programs for them, and it was a very exciting time. We focused on the broken window theory. I did the anti-graffiti task force. And it was Giuliani who suggested that I become a real estate developer. And that in itself, I should give credit to, because I wanted to be a social justice activist and a singer. That was the idea. I asked him, I love this work. I love working for the city. What can I do to keep serving the people? And he said, oh, you should consider being a real estate developer. And I thought that was insane. And I was very offended because I thought of Donald Trump in my head. And I thought, who, go figure, became a politician. But I thought about how greedy and selfish and tacky real estate developers can be, and mostly are.
We've got a great reputation.
And so I said, I'm an intellectual. I can't be a real estate developer. And he said, well, suit yourself. But if you think that you want to help the haves and the have-nots, it's the real estate developers that decide the allocation of land and access for the haves and the have-nots. So if you think that you're such a do-gooder, let's see what investment decisions you make when it's yours to make. And it was a very interesting challenge that stuck with me. And then, again, I had this idea for the Italian restaurant. I went back to Yale to go back to school. They were looking for a young person to play this very unique role in what became a world-renowned revitalization effort in New Haven. And when I pitched up with my idea for this Italian restaurant that I found out near Columbia University, they were intrigued and they said, guys, we found our lamb. And that was working for Bruce Alexander from the Rouse Company, who was a major pioneer of urban development.
And so the next step was the Christie Company.
Right.
And so you saw something in education that wasn't quite working in terms of blending the institutions themselves and their aspirations for growth with where the students themselves can reside.
Yeah, so it goes back to Giuliani again. So the Christie Company is named after my mother. That's her maiden name. And as background, my mother was an incredible urban educator, pioneer, worked in a really rough school, ultimately was assaulted by some students and could never teach again. And I spent much of my youth going to her school and very much immersed in that environment. And I loved the kids and I loved the teachers. I hated the facilities. I hated going to the bathroom. I remember that very distinctly. There was never any toilet paper. And it bothered me, and I would kind of hold it in because I was thinking, I don't want to go to the bathroom. And I remember thinking when my mother went through that very tragic situation, she could never teach again. I just remember leaving with the impression, well, they're probably really angry. I mean, why would you ever assault a teacher? They're probably really angry because there's an impression that you're given when you are treated in a manner where that you're kind of treated like animals. You don't even deserve toilet paper. And the time with Giuliani, one of the other things I did was they were fighting with the Board of Education, and they were trying to locate a bunch of schools in a creative way. And they asked me to go find some sites. And the key was they wanted to locate them in tax, you know, they make the site tax exempt. So that means find the worst possible commercial sites so that the opportunity cost of that site would be as low as possible, which meant that you're putting these schools in the worst possible neighborhoods. And that was unsettling. So since he told me that I had to be a real estate developer, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to push back a little bit and I'm going to become a school developer and I'm going to tackle this issue. And I realized that bonus FARs, which I think you have something similar
equivalency,
here. That's right. They could apply to school space and developers could actually make a lot of money if they were to build developments around taking the second and third floor, giving them to schools who will pay rent to them, and then taking 2 to 4 more floors on the top and selling them to whoever they want. The economics make sense. There was a culture misfit. Both the developers and the schools didn't like each other.
Sure.
So I came over here and I studied at Cambridge. And I took a year off my development career to do, in essence, a postdoc without the doc and looked at, well, what is the best environment in which we can learn, which turns out would look just like your office. This would be a great place to have a small school, this kind of setup. And then how could it work so that the developers didn't feel that the schools were adverse tenants and the schools didn't feel that there were risks to co-locating?
Taking that a step further, there's a lot of stats on your website suggesting, I guess it comes back a lot to the idea of both the broken windows that you alluded to earlier, but also in kind of biophilic response. So people working in nicer environments are going to perform better, their concentration levels are going to be better, and ultimately they'll be better students and hopefully attain better results from their education.
That's right.
Has that been kind of borne out in some of the stuff you've subsequently developed?
Well, yeah, and I think it's also played out in other people's developments as well. I mean, there were a lot of wonderful accidental developments that came after 9/11 and thereafter, just in the different real estate cycles when we had the real estate crash in, you know, 07, 08. There was just so much space that needed to be filled. Schools carried on. They still needed space, even though office tenants didn't exist. And so developers became flexible. And what they saw was very happy accidents, where the kids were performing better and the tenants, the office tenants, were happy to have these co-tenants. And what you saw was an uptick in volunteerism at the school and the synergies that were created. Some of the amenities from the school were used by office tenants and it was quite nice. You could have a library in the evening, things like that. In our projects, sure, no doubt. I mean, we make it the core of what we're doing. If you think about it, McKinsey, top firms, any top firm that's recruiting, what do they think about? They think of where they locate their office, how they design their offices, because they're thinking about human productivity. That's their most expensive cost. And so to not think about that for young people is simply foolish, because those young people are one of our most expensive investments.
Right.
So if we're losing 30 to 50% of their productivity because we don't put, you know, proper ventilation in the school buildings, or if we have them in dark spaces without light or whatnot, just makes no sense.
That's kind of one of the stats that I guess is more relevant to your work in Africa, but where you're saying that a change in temperature of 10 degrees effectively just totally nullifies your ability to concentrate
and retain information. And yet, and it's not even just in Africa. The same issue happened in New York City, where you would find that they would tack windows shut and they would they got over budget and they would drop HVAC from the scope of the project. And then you had kids in school over the summertime doing summer school. And what was the point in having them there in the summertime doing summer school when it's 90 degrees and therefore 95 to 100 degrees inside the building? Makes no sense. In Africa, there is sometimes some developers, they're chasing what they see abroad. So they're building buildings that are colonial style, but they're building them in West Africa, which is a climate where everybody needs to breathe. And it doesn't make any sense from an outputs perspective.
It looks like your work now spans anything from schools to universities. So are you pushing against an open door when you go to these institutions and give them a proposal where you're going to be creating great spaces, communities?
Yeah, if only it were pushing against open door. First of all, we have a couple of sort of principles and mantras. We don't pitch to anyone. In fact, there's no marketing in what we do. We go where we're invited. And that is very important because we're talking about paradigm shifts. So you want to be invited by a partner that's already done some soul searching themselves. They've already exhausted conventional opportunities. So they're a little bit more open-minded, maybe slightly more desperate to think outside the box, because what we do is outside the box. And we need that open-mindedness to work, to make the relationship work. It is not, you would think you're going to build schools in Africa or anywhere in the world. Who wouldn't want that? It is harder, much harder. We've had defaults. We've had to enforce defaults. There's nothing worse than having to enforce a default on a university, a public university. At the same time, you have to see the bigger picture, and we're creating a new market. That market needs to be accountable to private capital. If it's not, it will never get private capital. So sometimes you need to make sure that just like you're accountable to the school and to having affordable rents and to having the buildings built on time and maintained to an international best practice standard, they need to be accountable to paying the rent. So all of our structures are build, operate, transfer models. And so it's those BOTs are long-term leases.
Let's talk about the private capital element. Why are you so convinced that this is going to require private intervention to fix what is often a kind of public sector issue?
That's an excellent question. The math is undeniable at this point. If you look at Africa, and we could make the same argument for the US and the UK and elsewhere, but let's focus on Africa where it's most dire. There is an urgent need for about 6 to 7 million additional seats just to accommodate those students that have met the qualifications of university. They would matriculate, but for a lack of space.
Right.
So 6 to 7 million, that infrastructure costs at this point. I mean, we've put in some of our stats, 50 million, but when we did that information, probably by now it's $60 billion. So it's $60 billion, I'm going to estimate with inflation, from when we first started calculating, probably I would say 20% since then. That is 60 billion compared to about 2 billion in philanthropic and government capital that's available to build this infrastructure. So we're talking about well over a $50 billion funding gap. The only source of capital on the planet that's going to fill that gap is the private sector. So they have no choice. We have no choice. If we want an educated society that is safe and secure and stable, because their instability can beget our instability as well, as we found through the terrorism and whatnot, if we want a stable global climate, then we need to manifest education access around the world, and we need to build those buildings. So who's going to build them but for us?
If that 50 billion, 60 billion were available, what kind of education penetration rates would you be reaching in Africa? Is that going to bring it up to Western Europe?
Not even close. That will bring it up to half of the global average. So Western Europe and America are at about 60% penetration, gross enrollment ratio, that's what we call it. China, India, they're around 35%. South Korea is at almost 90%. South Korea is one of the best examples of how there, as a policy, they decided to double down and invest in higher education against all odds. South Korea and Ghana had the same GDP per capita in the 1950s. In fact, I want to say that, as I recall, Ghana was, I want to say, even a donor, because it was kind of a thing that they would be a donor country to South Korea and whatnot. And then South Korea said, we don't care what other people say, we're going to invest in higher education. They exploded. They have the highest GDP per capita growth year on year than any other country in the world. So if we make this investment, we'll go from the national average, or the global average is 27%. That will bring Africa to around 13 to 14%.
Right. So actually the funding gap, if you really want to push it, is, you know, hundreds of billions.
That's right.
You've clearly managed to raise capital to do this, but I imagine it's hard enough to do it in somewhere like the UK, where you're like, okay, we want to get risk capital for development in a public-private partnership, which frankly could take a hell of a long time. And now you're translating that to
Africa.
How does that private capital get on board with that?
A combination of factors. Part of it is that there are different products that help investors and developers to develop in the emerging world. One of them is your government has Commonwealth Development Corporation. We have OPIC, soon to be rebranded as DFC. Those bilateral trade investment facilitation, you know, they are putting down equity and debt on the side of patriotic investors. So they're looking for US or UK sponsored investors. And what they're doing is they're making political investments. They are saying, if you want to invest in Ghana, that's good for us. You are part of our diplomatic effort. So we're going to ensure, or we can provide insurance to you. If you work with the government, if you are concerned that there could be a default on their obligations, we will give you insurance to take away the outlandish risk that you can't otherwise mitigate. They can. And we've used that insurance in the past. And it makes a difference, because when there was a default, our investors were more than made whole.
The kind of product typology is the institutions themselves, the student beds, and then the
classrooms.
The classrooms, right, okay. Yeah. And presumably kind of commercial that works around and helps kind of integrate that community. This isn't specific to Africa, but anywhere where you're effectively taking all the entrepreneurial risk of creating this new environment, bringing these people together, all the hard work on the ground, you're facilitating what's going to be a much wider regeneration. Yeah. And then you see what, I don't know what you want to call them, kind of bloodsucker capitalists who come in along the edge and build a load of dross to kind of sponge off the work you've done initially.
Yeah.
Do you just have to kind of accept that as that's going to happen? Or can you tie down that land so that ultimately you can kind of control as much of it as possible?
And I'll admit, sometimes those bloodsucker investors are your investors. And then you really have an issue. I've dealt with that as well. And I think that we have a different perspective on our own contracts going forward. I mean, a lot of investors don't talk about this, but I've become a huge fan of the golden share. I don't know if you've heard of...
Yep.
Yeah, so golden shares are probably used more in the UK than the US, but I will never do an agreement without a golden share going forward, just to make sure that there's a certain level of social impact accountability that is uncompromising and that everybody's accountable to, no matter what.
Could you just explain the golden share concept?
So, typically what happens is that if you're the first investor, like I always am, it's always my money that goes in first. And I'm self-made. I didn't come from a rich family per se. I came from a loving family, but had to make it on my own and with their support. And so when I'm putting it in, I'm putting in the blood, sweat, tears, and, you know, pennies. And it takes a good chunk. It can take anywhere from, people always ask, how much does it really take to get to a financial close? It takes between $1 and $3 million to get to financial close. And you kind of cobble it together however you can. You bring in other smaller investors towards the end. But it always starts with your dollar or your pound. When you bring in the real capital, which is tens of millions of dollars, of course you're diluting yourself in favor of that majority investor or that majority investor consortium. That's when you lose control of your project to a certain extent in the event that things start to go wrong. You control it day to day, but the moment things start to go outside of the business plan, that's when there's an enormous amount of leverage that they can have over you. What the golden share does is it ensures that even if they exercise those material decision rights, that you can also veto them again if the exercise of those rights, or they're exercising those rights, in some ways impedes or conflicts with some of the social impact metrics, or in any way negatively impacts the beneficiary community or, you know, vulnerable populations that were affected, you can prescribe what the social impact is and say, this is golden. You can't touch this. And if they do something, if they make a material decision, whether it's to walk, whether it's to sell or something, if it goes against that, you can veto that decision using your golden share.
If all goes well, it's effectively a traditional investment piece. It's like, look, you're here to make money. We've got a social aim, but ultimately, you know, you want to return your capital. But it's with the understanding that there is a line in the sand that we're not going to cut corners at the cost of those key social goals.
That's right. And we can't be too greedy. You know, we have identified a plan that has a balanced return that is focused on social outputs as much as economic outputs. The way that this paradigm shift works is that the universities make the most money, the students benefit profoundly, the governments benefit, and the investors make a fair and reasonable return. When that goes off kilter in either direction, if the university defaults, they need to be held accountable. If the investor gets greedy and it's at the expense of the beneficiaries who are young people, they need to be held accountable. And your job, my job, is to hold everybody accountable, including myself.
And you're now working globally. Is it still on a kind of demand basis? So are you able to pick and choose your projects?
Yes. We will never have enough bandwidth to do all of the projects that come to us. I regret that we can't spend more time with the projects, the countries that reach out and the wonderful projects that reach out to us. In fact, we're building an app right now that's targeting student loans for girls, which is an issue. It's called Girls First Finance, and I'm very excited about it. But on the back of that, we're using that same infrastructure to create, in essence, an online portal so that all of the different projects that come to us, and there are myriad projects, they can, in essence, upload their due diligence documents to us. We can at least do them the solid of giving them some kind of credit look, some kind of screening that says, this is how we would rate you. And then we can take that information and try to match it with a local bank or some other financier that might be interested, even if we're not.
On social value, social causes, it seems like technology is now actually kind of turning it away from just something nice to do, but we don't really know how to value it, to actually enabling it to be something which everyone can benefit from. So it's not just altruistic. You can actually harness social value for your own kind of capitalist purposes. Are there any kind of real examples in what you're doing where technology is kind of really changing how you can gauge the metrics or how you can kind of really prove out the value you're creating?
I think this new venture is a great example of it. It's not a real estate venture per se, but it's related to the real estate. So when we're investing, our projects are typically between $50 and $75 million. It's a large investment in these universities. It's a game-changing investment. It was deeply unsettling and uncomfortable for us to discover as part of our, and I don't even want to call it due diligence because it was well after we closed on some of the projects, that upwards of 50% of the girls at those public university campuses were being exploited and forced to sell their bodies to pay their school fees. And so here we were championing and we were so excited about our green development strategies and our renewable energy, but we missed this incredibly exploitative human ring that was affecting these young girls. And I, especially as a female entrepreneur, who's also a survivor myself and from work-related ventures, I decided that this was not something that we could turn a blind eye to at all. So we pulled together, we looked at it, and we said, what these girls need are loans. They're trying to pay for their education, and they're doing whatever they have to do. And I don't fault them for it, because if I were in the same position, I probably would too, because education is such a game changer. What we know, going back to social impact, is that a girl's education has the highest leverage factor in terms of long-term GDP growth in an economy. So if you have a choice against conventional wisdom, if you have a choice between educating a girl and a guy, you'll get more bang for your buck when you educate the girl. But that isn't what happens culturally. So what we saw was that if we could use technology, because we didn't have the infrastructure, we don't have the infrastructure to underwrite all these loans across all these are very small loans. There are thousands of students that are affected at just one university,
right,
where we're investing in Kenyatta University. That's upwards of potentially 10 to 15,000 girls just at that university that are sometimes being exploited just so they can get a smartphone. So going back to technology, access to a phone, access to data, access to the internet, it's game changing for them. So we launched Girls First Finance. We're in the process of launching it. it's basically phones, loans, and support. So you start with the phone. The whole thing is administered from your phone. That's relevant because that app, nobody's really collected data on the behavior of these young girls in these countries related to technology because they haven't had it. They haven't had the phones. So we've made these phones. We're making them available through partnerships with Vodafone and others. And then we're gonna they're gonna have this app, which is there's a free version, there's a premium version. From the app, we are looking at things like getting them mentors, we're getting them access to internships and jobs, trauma therapy, a database where they can confidentially report sexual assault and abuse. 90% of them have reported that at least one professor is exploiting them for sex for grades. So the pressure on these girls to succeed is, I mean, we're talking about what happens to your concentration when the temperature's not right. Now imagine when your professor is failing you because you won't sleep with him. And so, and this is going on. This is known. The administrations have talked to us about it. They admit it. So we're trying to work with them. We're working with your government to try to put together some framework agreements to help it. So anyway, we're going to be able to monitor this from this technology tool, this app. It's game changing.
Are the loans provided through P2P or from a kind of governmental source?
From us. We are raising the capital and providing the loans. And part of the reason why we're also doing it is because, you know, we want to make sure it's not how we underwrite a deal, but it helps to risk mitigate the credit of a university's, you know, in essence, future enrollment projections if we know that we're providing financing to some of their students in hard currency. So we're kind of ticking a lot of boxes and killing a lot of birds with one stone, so to speak. What a terrible expression, though. But yeah.
But it makes sense. So you're involved in, you know, the whole community. You can't just kind of build the beds and walk away from it. I guess that's kind of symptomatic of change you see, or we're seeing kind of across all the sectors. But do you find it strange? I don't know if it's the same in the US, but certainly in the UK, the student developers who've by and large done a very good job, but it's very much focused on the halls of residence, and it doesn't extend to, you know, working with the actual institutions to build out their own facilities and integrate them.
I think that comes out of fear. I think that culture clash that I talked about at the very beginning of my career, where I said developers and schools don't really trust each other. So I have a mantra for all of the projects that we do. Three ingredients are required for a successful deal, close, relationship, anything. And that's trust, culture, and courage. Two parties need to trust each other. They need to trust somebody in between. Local culture always prevails, and you can't mitigate every single risk. So sometimes you need to have the courage to come together and proceed. That local culture and the trust, I think that not-for-profits and for-profit, the greedy capitalists and the do-gooder charities, they don't trust each other. And they both have faults, honestly. They both look at it with faults. I've had a lot of charities that have not been accountable to the amount of money that we've invested in helping them sort out their problems. And there have been a lot of investors that don't care enough about the students as beneficiaries. So it goes both ways. And then in the local culture, they come from such different cultures. And you have to invest in understanding a school culture. You're negotiating not with a commercial person, you're oftentimes negotiating with an academic who might have studied botany or art history and is terrified to do this deal with you, but needs to for the sake of his or her institution.
So changing tack.
Yeah.
I know you've come straight from Jazz FM.
Yep.
And your album is coming out early next year.
That's right.
So how have you managed to kind of weave in your clear kind of passion for music with what's clearly a fairly hectic real estate career?
I took some time off of music when I was first launching Africa Integros in the early years. And then what I realized is that there was a complete disconnect between the administrations we were negotiating with and the young people that they were serving. And that a lot of these cultures, and even in our cultures, there's still too healthy of an attitude that young people should be seen and not heard. And I think it's very unhealthy in terms of developing critical thinking skills and agency and having a voice in activism, which we need our young people. I mean, look at what's going on in the world right now. We need young people to speak up and to feel comfortable doing so. I found that wasn't happening. I couldn't get to them through the administration, but I could get to them through music. And so as a songwriter and a producer, I started creating music that would resonate with them. And I'm quite introverted, so I wasn't even, I've actually never been on Facebook in my life, but although there is now a Facebook page for me, evidently, I think they're about to launch it, but I joined social media 2 years ago. I literally pivoted and realized that there was an opportunity to connect with our beneficiaries, which is, they are what all of this is about. This is not, there are easier ways to make money. So this is not about making money. This is about how do we empower the next generation, because we're going to need them to save us. We're not doing such a good job right now with our governance. And so we can't empower them unless they have a vibrant climate of success in which they learn and unless they feel comfortable speaking up when they see something that's wrong. So I gave you the statistics of how many people are being exploited. There's clearly an issue with speaking up. And we use this music to address that.
Do you feel you're now in a good place where you've successfully blended one of the two, or is there going to be a later transition?
Well, let me put it this way. I think all artists, having immersed myself and I've managed artists and I've produced artists, I think all artists have downtime. I just happen to use my downtime to do my other hustles and to do these other companies. I think it takes a team. I have an excellent team. I'm blessed to have a business manager who looks after Shanique Downey. She looks after all of the affairs of all of the different companies. And sometimes she's organizing a video shoot. On Monday, we were doing a video shoot. While I was at the video shoot, she was giving feedback to the app developers in Argentina who are finishing our app. Then the next day I was, doing something related to the infrastructure and the real estate side. And next week is UN week. I will be doing music and development hand in hand. This morning I'm doing that a little bit. The team helps to make it work. And I just try to not put myself in a box and be open-minded. I've been blessed to have investors that think it's cool.
I shall put the links to your BBC and Jazz FM podcasts up on our site so people can listen to the music side as well.
Appreciate that.
So I want to our last three questions. And so the first is, if you could recommend our listeners one book that's influenced your thinking and what you do, what would it be?
One book?
Yeah.
Jane Jacobs. She was a housewife. She was a woman way ahead of her time. Her book on American cities, she in her own right was very educated and had a beautiful view of how local merchants and kind of street fronts and how communities, in essence, could govern themselves and how vibrant communities could sustain themselves if built in the right way. It was a very female perspective to development. And I think one of the reasons why I've stayed in development is because women do bring a different perspective. We build horizontally. We don't build as much vertically. And that's quite important because people are coming together and gathering at the interface of the public and the private space and the indoor and the outdoor. And so how you plan that is quite critical. So that's, I'm cheating now, The Power Broker and Bob Moses, Everything Not to Do in Development. And so, if you read both of those books, you'll get a pretty good...
He's writing about what not to do, or he's just writing about what he thinks he should do.
And it was about him. So right, Bob Moses, I don't know if you
guys
know.
I didn't know Bob Moses.
Okay, so Robert Moses is the guy that created the American highway.
Right.
He was terribly racist and classist and thought that highways were for the middle class and that everybody was going to have a driver. And so therefore, all of the highways should go next to the water so that everybody driving along the ocean in the evening, exactly. And so all of our worst urban renewal disasters were created because he bifurcated cities, the way that he built those highways. He was like the Antichrist to Jane Jacobs. They were contemporaries. So she was picketing in the streets of New York City while he was running the Triborough, the Port Authority and all of these. He ran, and the most incredible thing, and you should read this book, The Power Broker, who was written, oh gosh, now it's terrible. It was written by, well, you can look it up. There's only one of them. And he had a war chest of money because his budget was not beholden to city or state approval. It was the revenues from the tolls from the bridges he built. And he was unstoppable for decades. He's the one that created the housing developments in New York City that were copied around the world, really, and around America.
The father of urban sprawl.
That's right.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, exactly. So between the two of them, at least on the urban development side, those are two books that anchored me in two directions.
Do you have a favorite building?
Oh, a favorite building. If I were to go nostalgic and favorite building, I'll say them quickly. So I love the Bilbao Guggenheim Museum, which is a Gehry building. Love it. Could go there as much as possible just to see the sun set on it. It's like a fire when the sun sets on it. Dancing Couple in Prague is an incredible building. I want to say that McKinsey's office is there. It's one building twisting into the other. As a young person, it inspired me to see it. And then the third is a shout out to Cesar Pelli, who recently passed, and he was a great influence on me, having cut my teeth as a developer in New Haven, where his office is located. The World Financial Center, what a lot of people don't realize about that building was the use of the skin of the building. So he found this reflective glass so that if you ever look at those buildings and you look at them in comparison to other buildings around them, they're always the same color as the sky. If the sky is gray, the buildings are gray. If the sky is blue, the buildings are blue. And it makes them look very light and very just as if they're floating on the skyline. And right next to them are some very dark, drab, black buildings with black windows. And they're very heavy, but those buildings never look heavy. And I just thought he was so thoughtful to context. And so that was very inspiring to me.
Well, I think we can take all three. It's very nice.
I cheated, but...
Cool. Final question is, which technology business or idea is your tip to impact the built environment in years to come?
In some ways, I think that financing... young people's education in terms of what it's going to do to empower them with capital will be quite huge, because it will take on. So if we get this right, I'm not saying that we're the next Uber, but who knows? It is. There are tens of millions of girls that are currently out of school because they can't finance their education. If we really got it right, and if it blows up, then that will absolutely impact who can finance buildings based on the revenue streams that come from that.
And have you launched yet?
No, we're going to launch in the next month.
Have you got a name?
Girls First Finance.
Okay, cool.
Maybe what I should say is the best technology is the worst technology. I think Amazon is going to kill the built environment. And so, you know, it's terrible to say, but they're killing stores in a people don't go to stores to shop anymore.
So put it another way, how do you, in your designs, kind of reflect the changing shape of the economy in that sense?
Smaller merchants. Okay. I've always felt that way, but I feel it even more now. There will always be a desire by smaller artisans or entrepreneurs. They got to get their start somehow. Even Amazon began in somebody's garage. So by deferring to them in their space, you can create kind of cookie cutter vinyl boxes that can turn over, and some of them will fail, some of them will grow out of it. But what I don't trust are the ethics and values of national chains and what they'll do when they're publicly listed and their revenues dip. Because the thing that we all know, it's not just that the lease is signed and that you get revenues. They have to occupy the space. It has to be vibrant. They have to keep it open until late into the evening. Otherwise, it doesn't feed the other co-tenants. So...
yeah, got to make it work together. Awesome. Look, thank you very much for joining us. And best of luck with both the music and the development.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
One of the really exciting elements of a boom in technology is how it can enable property ownership to migrate to a deeper form of operational management. Nowhere is this more evident than in terms of community and social value, where the ability to interact with the end user is easier than ever before. There are caveats, however. As Andrea's Girls First Finance initiative shows, operationally minded and social value driven developers and owners are going to need to be comfortable with stepping incrementally further outside of their traditional boundaries if they're to succeed in creating true and lasting social change and benefit. As ever, if you've enjoyed the episode, please do recommend the show to a friend or a colleague. It's hugely appreciated. Until next time, thank you for listening.